Good morning. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect it is 9:01 a.m. on Tuesday, March 8th, 2022. Present today, Representative Thompson, Representative Lavon, Vice Chair Ortiz, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. We also have Representative Fields with us today. Thank you for being here. This morning, we will consider two pieces of legislation, House Bill 158, PFD Contributions to the General Fund, House Bill 149, Child Care Provider Collective Bargaining. And with that, Representative Fields, welcome back to House Finance. If you could place yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thanks, Chair Merrick. You and committee members may have heard from local business people about the challenges that they've had with workforce and having an adequate supply of child care for people to get back in the labor market as we recover from COVID. I think, you know, when you talk to business owners and people who are trying to hire, and certainly child care providers, there's been a shortage of child care for a long time, and that shortage of child care is directly related to the low wages in the sector. The low wages make it impossible to recruit and retain to an adequate level to supply child care, which is necessary for people to work. But the pandemic has really exacerbated this problem, and I think it's fair to say the child care sector is in crisis. So in the Labor and Commerce Committee, we tried to brainstorm every idea we could think of to support the child care sector, and we actually passed a couple of bills, one of which was a tax credit for employers who provide child care either on-site or through a subsidy, and the other bill was this bill, which takes a little bit more of a systematic approach. And it was interesting through the labor and commerce process to hear from stakeholders, and I think I learned a lot through that process. And the number one thing I've heard from providers is they need to be empowered to have a little more control over their own destiny and fix this systemic problem of inadequate wages to recruit and retain workforce. So that is the impetus for House Bill 149. And, you know, I think the problem is fairly obvious. If the average wage, and it is around $13.50 per hour, and Target and Safeway are paying $20 per hour, you're never going to have enough child care providers. And I think the difference between child care and, say, a coffee shop is that, you know, if there's an inadequate supply of coffee at a coffee shop, that doesn't necessarily have a systemic impact on your economy. If there's an inadequate supply of child care, and that prevents working age people in every other industry from being at work, then it does have a systemic effect on your economy. It's a very negative effect on your economy. So I see child care as a necessary service so that people can participate in the workforce, and we want people to participate in the workforce.
Thank you. The record reflect at 9:03. We are joined by Representative Foster.
The other thing to think about in terms of economic competitiveness is how early childhood education is essential in terms of human capital development and workforce development. If you haven't read the academic studies on investments in early childhood education, they have the highest return on investment. We know that providing good early childhood care does produce workers who are going to be more productive over the long term. The economist who really formalized this and was rewarded with the Nobel Prize for it is named James Heckman, and you can see that graph. Economic impact of investing in early childhood learning has a higher ROI than at any other stage in life, including later in life.
Thank you. Let the record reflect at 9:04 a.m. we were joined by Representatives Johnson, Josephson, and Edgman.
So having addressed the general need for strengthening the child care sector and specifically expanding supply of quality early childhood education, I want to refer to what some other states have done in terms of experimenting to strengthen the sector. First of all, it's important to reference every other developed country on the planet invests a significant amount of money directly in the provision of child care, generally on the order of somewhere between $10,000 per child per year and $30,000 per child per year at the high end in Norway. In the U.S., it's under $1,000 per year. So we have to recognize that right now we're different. We do not make a meaningful investment in subsidizing child care for working families. Every other Western country does. So if we don't do that, and we're not going to make the political decision to start investing thousands of dollars per child per year, which is what every other country does, then what are we going to do to strengthen the sector? 11 other states have established bargaining structures for home-based child care providers to bargain with the state to provide livable wages and benefits that expand the supply of child care. Illinois was the first state to develop this in 2005. California was the most recent. And this, it's called a sectoral bargaining model, where you bargain as a sector, not one employer, but the entire sector, workers and owners alike. That's what House Bill 149 does, and it is based on this model that 11 other states have developed.
Thank you, and let the record reflect, we have Representative Carpenter online. Thank you, Representative Carpenter.
So House Bill 149 looks at one model for expanding the supply of childcare by directly addressing the issue of inadequate wages. I think it's important to note, HB 149 and the sectoral bargaining model is not the only option. And there are a lot of other options out there, and I want to lay some out that we thought about in labor and commerce. Number one, we could directly supply care. I don't think we have the political will right now to start directly subsidizing childcare on an ongoing basis to the tune of thousands of dollars per child per year, which again, that's what every other Western country does. I don't think we have the political bandwidth to do it, whatever the merits of that may be. That would be number one policy option, directly subsidize care. The second policy option that's out there that we looked at is a sectoral bargaining structure that's opt-in. It's not coercive on private employers. That's House Bill 149. The third option is, and a lot of child care providers have discussed this, we as policymakers could say, hey, if you're working in the child care industry, you're going to receive a living wage. We could index it. There are a lot of ways we could set up a living wage. That is a simple policy. I think the big con with establishing a living wage in the child care sector is that living wage might not be economically viable in the absence of adequate subsidies. So we could say, hey, you're going to pay $18 an hour. Well, if we aren't providing subsidies, then we're forcing parents to make up that difference. And child care is already too expensive for many parents as it is. So as we look to strengthening the sector, we have to be really sensitive to not raising prices on parents. And that's the problem with just mandating a living wage. Number four, we could establish a prevailing wage policy for child care providers. This is a lot like what we do with construction. If you receive public construction dollars through the state of Alaska, you're subject to the Little Davis-Bacon prevailing wage law. It's over 60 bucks an hour, full package right now. We could do that in the child care industry because, you know, decades ago in construction, we made a choice. We said construction is going to be a middle class job and you're going to receive a living wage and benefits if you do public construction. We could do the same in child care. I would say the challenge with simply mandating prevailing wages in child care is that I don't think there's actually enough public investment in child care right now for a prevailing wage model to work. Because when you look at the construction industry, the prevailing wage model works because we put about $1 billion per year into federal public construction, and then we put some more into state construction. It's a lot of money in the sector. We don't put nearly that much money in the child care sector. So if we're not having that critical mass of investment, would a prevailing wage policy work? I'm not confident that it would.
Thank you. Let the record reflect we are joined by Representative Wool at 9:08 a.m.
I know the Finance Committee is principally charged with looking at the finances of this bill, but I do think it's important to lay out the different policy options so you have the background of what we looked at in labor and commerce. So I just mapped out on an X and Y axis the relative coerciveness and relative cost of different policy options when it comes to child care. Your most coercive option is to just mandate a minimum or a living wage for child care providers. A prevailing wage is a little less coercive. Of course, the least coercive is just to pump money into the sector. I would be supportive of doing that. I don't think we have the political bandwidth to do that. The bill that you have before you, House Bill 149, a sectoral bargaining model, is the least coercive and the least expensive. It would not fix all the problems in the child care sector overnight. I think it would empower the sector to start fixing some of those problems by getting at their root causes. So, what are the goals of House Bill 149? Provide the industry with a structure where they can begin to raise wages and benefits so that workers have a living wage, more workers enter the industry and fewer leave, and thus increase the supply of quality child care available to everyone else in the marketplace. And the key is to empower the sector to be driving this so that we don't raise prices to the point that it's unaffordable on parents, so that we maintain economics that work for child care providers. Because whatever your situation as a provider, whether you're a home-based provider, whether you're a nonprofit provider, whether you're one of the very few for-profit providers, your finances have been strapped. We have to be really sensitive to supporting our child care providers and not putting them out of business, because the last 2 years have just been incredibly hard for this sector and for every provider in the sector. And finally, I think it's important that if we're going to legislate in this space, we recognize that circumstances are going to change, economics are going to change for providers, for families, and I think that our policy structure should be flexible enough to let the industry adapt to changing circumstances. If the industry gets another infusion of federal funding, like from ARPA, we should empower them to be investing that funding in the most sensible way.
Thank you. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm sorry I'm late today, and if I missed anything, forgive me and my questions. But you just said an interesting point. You said you don't want to raise prices to make it unaffordable for parents. Does that mean you're willing to raise it a little bit? Because from what I hear in my experience and everyone I talk to, many, it's unaffordable already. And a lot of parents opt not to put their kids in child care because it doesn't pay. So they'd rather just stay home than basically break even and work all day and have someone else raise their kids. So I contend that it is basically unaffordable for many families. So how do you combat that?
It is unaffordable for many families. And, you know, when you look at what people actually pay for the care that they receive, families that are lucky and have high-paying jobs get to send their kids to pretty high-quality child care centers. You know, my wife and I pay well over $2,000 a month for the care for our two kids, larger than most people's mortgage. It's so expensive that it doesn't even make sense to go to work to pay for child care in many jobs. That is terrible for our economy because we're deterring people from entering the labor force. So the structure of this bill provides a framework for child care providers to negotiate with the state to allocate scarce resources. So just to give an example, if this bill had been in place when the state got $2 million per year in additional ARPA funding, child care providers, owners, and workers would have directly been at the table with the child care program office to allocate that $2 million per year. My suspicion is they wouldn't have wanted to raise prices on parents one penny because parents were strapped during the pandemic as well. But I don't want to micromanage those decisions on resource allocation. I think the sector should drive that. Child care providers should drive those decisions. Right now, we're basically leaving it up to the CCPO, the Child Care Program Office within HESS. That office was unstaffed for months. It's finally been filled. I think it's like a lot of things at HESS. The long-term employees at HESS are incredibly devoted to their jobs. But there's no substitute for the industry being at the table to allocate scarce resources in a sector that's as challenging as the childcare sector. You know, the best state employee in the world is never gonna have the granularity of detail about what's going on at the sector level, if they're not talking with providers. The providers have to be driving these investments. And that's the premise of the bill. We're not micromanaging how they allocate it.
Thank you, Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative, for presenting today. Your first bullet says you increase wages and benefits so workers have a living wage, and I think we could all support everyone having a living wage. Right now, the pressure on a daycare operator is if you pay your worker a greater salary and provide more benefits, if you want to maintain your profit margin, you have to bump up your rate. Does the state have a program to help lower income families receive a subsidy on their payment for daycare services? And could you describe how that program would work with this type of a increase in wages and benefits? In other words, could you pass along the added expense to the state through a subsidy?
Through the chair, Representative Lebon, you are correct. The state does have a subsidy program for lower income parents. Right now, the level of those subsidies is not sufficient to cover the cost of the care. So like the child care center where my kids go does have subsidized slots. In effect, because those subsidies don't provide the full cost of care, other parents, me, we effectively are subsidizing the other kids at that school because the slots are not adequately funded. There's also an inadequate number of slots. So the slots that are there are not sufficiently funded, and then there just aren't enough of them. Under this bill, we are not mandating a living wage. We're not mandating that the state increase the number of those slots. We're creating a structure where child care providers would be deciding, okay, if we get $2 million more per year in ARPA funding, how much of that is going into higher wages and benefits for workers? How much of that maybe is going to increase the dollars per slot so it more closely matches what it actually costs to provide care? Or how many dollars go into increasing the number of slots? Because I think if you ask providers, they would actually want to do all of those. We face resource constraints. So how do you balance multiple meritorious investments? And I think we've got to provide the right structure, and it's going to be hard for us as legislators to say at any given point in time, okay, today we should raise wages 10 cents and increase the number of slots by 20. Hard to make those decisions when we don't have that detailed view of the industry.
So as a follow-up, Madam Chair, thank you. So if I'm an operator of a daycare center and I now need to pay a higher wage and provide improved benefits, the state formula would not help me cover that expense the way it's currently written. Maybe that needs to be looked at. But for me as an operator, if I'm mandated to pay the higher wages and provide greater benefits, which may be good for the employee, and you know that maybe is beyond dispute, it would be good, but if my profit margin was squeezed and I couldn't pass that added cost to the state, then do you run the risk of putting daycare centers out of business if they can't pass along that higher cost to the family because they're paying more out of pocket, whether it be you who's paying 100% of the cost or a lower income family? And I don't even know what the split is. Is it a 50-50 split? I couldn't even tell you what it is. But I guess the free market system would say you're squeezing the operator and they may not be able to recover that added cost.
Yeah, and through the chair, you're right, Representative LeBond, and that's why this bill does not mandate a living wage or a minimum wage in the sector, because I think it would put at risk that we would make it uneconomic to provide care for some providers. Instead, this bill provides a framework. All this bill does is provide a framework for childcare providers to work with the state to figure out how do we raise wages, how do we allocate these scarce resources. I don't think we know enough to set a minimum wage, like you say, without having potentially unintended negative impacts on providers.
Thank you. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Representative Fields, you mentioned something that gave me an idea, which you mentioned you had two kids in daycare simultaneously. I fortunately had mine sequentially, but it stretched out for many years, so I only had one in at a time. But I remember waiting for kindergarten to start so I wouldn't have to pay for daycare, and at the time kindergarten was half a day in Fairbanks. Now it's a full day, which brings me to the pre-K concept, which I know you put a lot of energy in and spent a lot of time thinking about. And for my kids, whether they were in daycare or preschool or whatever they called it, it didn't really matter. They were somewhere where parents could work. So is there some sort of synergy, or have you thought about, you know, we talk about funding statewide universal pre-K, which I'm sure has a pretty big price tag. Could some of that funds go towards helping daycare programs be more robust and maybe more cost effective than trying to do a full-blown pre-K, which from my understanding requires a lot of certified teachers and education specialists, which I'm not sure is necessarily what everyone is looking for.
Through the chair, yes, I think any increase in pre-K funding and the range of numbers we've talked about is basically augmenting care, and it's not replacing the private preschool that's out there. And because there's such a large need, I think there's no risk that we're going to have too much pre-K. All we're doing is filling some of the need.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, and I know you're, this is probably a couple of slides ahead, but your plan would be to have this class of workers be able to negotiate under PARA, the Public Employees Relations Act. Is that correct?
Great question. Let me explain this. And this is, I would say, fairly arcane in terms of labor relations. So to answer your question, we have to go back to the National Labor Relations Act, which was passed in the 1930s, and because Congress at the time had a sort of northern liberal, southern Dixiecrat coalition, in order to establish collective bargaining rights, the Dixiecrats demanded exclusion of domestic work and farm work because it was primarily done by black people, a reality of racism at the time. Because of that, state legislatures have the ability to manage labor relations in those two areas, domestic work and farm work. So we can say, hey, in domestic work, and that's what this bill does, in the area of childcare, we're going to establish a sectoral bargaining structure rather than the traditional employee-employer bargaining structure that we see for every other field that's out there. We would be preempted by federal law from doing this in, say, healthcare or construction. Those are clearly regulated under the National Labor Relations Act. Because the NLRA excluded domestic work, we have a lot of flexibility as a state legislature to say, hey, we want to establish a sectoral bargaining model, which is what 11 other states have done. Under a sectoral bargaining model, I want to be really clear, these childcare employees will not be public employees. However, you have to have a way for them to bargain. And in working with Ledge Legal, the way to establish a bargaining path for them would be for the Alaska Labor Relations Agency to manage an election where all providers, again, employees and the employers, because in a lot of cases they're the same person in a home-based setting, they would vote on, hey, do we want to engage in sectoral bargaining? That would be a vote conducted by ALRA. If a majority of participants voted yes, then they would have a sectoral bargaining framework. And then the sector, the childcare sector, would negotiate not employee versus employer, but sector, childcare providers, with the state childcare program office. And that's where they would make these allocation decisions around resources. How are we gonna allocate scarce resources? And if childcare providers wanted to, they could also negotiate for things like, hey, we wanna look at, say, a minimum wage in the sector that might be linked to training. We want to look at benefits. They would have the ability to do that. This bill does not mandate that they bargain on any specific thing in their sector. Sectoral bargaining may not be familiar to many people in the U.S., but sectoral bargaining is actually how most bargaining is done in many Northern European countries. And the way it works is the industry drives what is the issues addressed at the bargaining table. So wages may be a priority, safety may be a priority in particular industry, benefits, the linkage between wages and training, that's determined by the industry. We don't have to micromanage it. This bill does not micromanage it. Because again, the childcare providers are gonna be sensitive to their needs every year, and I think we should establish a structure that allows them to make those decisions.
Yes, follow up?
So the state agency, ALRA, would act as the umpire, essentially.
In conducting an election to determine if the sector wants to do this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. There's so much here I could dig into. But first of all, I just want to start with your statistics on Norway. I was just wondering why you chose that particular country to point out.
Through the chair, because based on my memory, they were at the high end of investment per year per child, so just to show a range.
So would it surprise you to know that they have about 5.5 million people? They have $1.3 trillion in their sovereign wealth fund. Their budget is $18 billion, and they have a birth rate of 11 children per thousand. Maybe they have a little more money than we do, for starters, plus centuries of infrastructure. So I'm just trying to get the apples and apples comparison here.
Yeah, through the chair, I think that really is our challenge, and I fully acknowledge we're not going to be investing thousands of dollars per child per year in childcare this year. So how do we establish a structure where we empower providers to have a little more voice in allocating these scarce resources?
So you have 11 states, or is that what you said? 11 states that are unionized. How is Detroit doing? Or sorry, I'm throwing Detroit in there, but it's Illinois. Talk to me a little bit about Illinois' retention right now.
In labor and commerce, we heard from providers in the state of Washington who have done this, and they described, through the chair, the positive impact. And it was over time. You know, they establish a model, and then over time, they improve conditions in the sector. And we heard that from providers. We have not heard testimony from providers in Illinois yet.
Thank you. And following up, let's see. this government getting involved in this?
What? Sorry,
I mean,
through the chair.
Wouldn't this be a kind of a grassroots organized either by the unions or by the workers?
Through the chair, yes. California was the most recent state to engage in sectoral bargaining, and it took 10 years of working with providers, working with state policymakers, educating people. It is complicated policy, and I certainly recognize that. I guess the problem I saw is that here we have employers and parents who are saying, we've got a real problem, and there weren't, I didn't see solutions on the table, so I wanted to put forward a potential solution, and, you know, I was really clear in labor and commerce, hey, if someone has a better idea, let's pursue it. I haven't seen a better idea yet. Maybe the finance committee will have one.
Follow up. A better idea for what?
For how to address the very pressing needs that we have in the child care sector.
And those are?
A lack of adequate supply of child care and affordable child care for parents.
What's the percentage? Do you have a percentage of unfilled need?
Gosh, you know, it's really hard to say that when you look at, I've heard a lot of anecdotal stories of parents who have been forced to stay out of the workforce. I've heard from visitors from business organizations visiting my office saying that this is one of our top issues, but I don't have a number of parents, and I don't know if it would be quantifiable, a number of parents who haven't been able to get care.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the chair, are there child care providers that support this kind of legislation? I imagine the employees do, but do the providers, are they concerned that if the employees organize, that their wages will go up, and then the facilities will have to charge more, and we'll go down that spiral?
I have heard support from some child care providers and questions from others. This bill is actually, and like I said, it's an opt-in model. It's actually a right-to-work model. It does. If the sector decided to bargain sectorally, no individual child care provider is required to participate in that. And that's why I say it's not coercive. And I don't think there would be support from providers if it was coercive. That's something that we've had roundtables with child care providers to talk through how the bill would actually work. So I would say we've heard some support, but it's a diverse sector. There are hundreds of providers. Some of them are individual home-based providers, and I one of my goals has been to meet with and talk with as many of them as possible. I think one thing that's very clear from providers is they want more of a voice, and that's the number one goal of the bill.
And we do have invited testimony.
Okay, last question.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So if I were to try to get my head around this bill, it allows the workers in child care facilities to organize, come to the table with the employers, and perhaps to get them better wages and living working conditions without raising the rates on the parents of the kids. It would be a way to, or in an organized way, to get more ARPA funds or government subsidies. Ultimately, that's going to fill the gap, right?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I think you described exactly what would happen. And through the chair, I might, of course, I didn't know the answer, but my staff did, Representative Johnson. There was a recent survey of parents, and 77% of parents reported missing work due to child care issues in the last 3 months. This is a survey, so it's not like they asked every Alaskan, but in theory, a representative survey, and 36% of parents postponed school or training due to child care issues, and 7% of parents had to leave a job due to inadequate child care, and 26% of parents basically have to lean on family members because adequate formal child care is not available in Alaska.
Thank you. Can you cite the where that survey came from, please?
Yes, this is a Center for American Progress report, Untapped Potential in Alaska. I don't know if my staff wants to provide additional detail on this particular survey.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Fields. The report in question should be in members' packets. I apologize for the length, but it's a U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation on untapped potential in Alaska, and this was published in part, I believe, with the Alaska Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Okay, please continue.
These are great questions, and I really appreciate the engagement by committee members. Just want to note the most recent state to go down this road, California, the providers in working with the state were able to negotiate a 15% reimbursement rate increase. So again, this bill is just a framework. Real progress will happen over time as the sector bargains with the state, but I think we see here California immediately making some measurable progress. And that's it. Happy to answer further questions, and I really appreciate the opportunity to present the bill.
Thank you. Further questions before invited testimony?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair.
Oh, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I would appreciate the opportunity to have a policy conversation about this issue. It appears that it would affect a lot of different sectors throughout the economy. I'd like to take a step back and ask a question about what is the constitutional authority that the bill draws upon to even do something like this.
Thanks, through the chair, to Representative Carpenter. Again, it's because the federal government has not preempted us in the area of labor relations with respect to domestic workers, which include child care, therefore we have the ability to set labor policy. And our purview is very limited to domestic workers and farm workers under the 1937 National Labor Relations Act. So it would be Article 10 of the Constitution, all matters not managed by the federal government or left to the states.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. I was more pointing to the state constitution, not the federal constitution.
Thanks, Representative Carpenter. I'm not sure I understand the question. Do you think that the state constitution doesn't authorize us to deal with child care policy? Or I'm not sure, I guess.
I guess it's a policy call that we're trying to make in statute here. And the question ought to be asked, what is it, since power is reserved to the people unless it's specifically granted to the state in our Constitution, then what is it, which clause, which portion of the Constitution allows the state to create law that would affect so many sectors of the economy? What is it that we're drawing upon? Is it just a general welfare clause that says we can do whatever we want if we have enough votes? Or is there some other portion of the Constitution, that the state Constitution, that we're drawing on that says this is, you know, like we say, we have to have an education system because the Constitution says so. So what is it that we're drawing upon that says this is authorized by our state constitution to go down this road?
Right. Through the chair, I guess I see this as simply enabling commerce and full participation by parents in the workforce, which, to be honest, I have not gone back and looked at what is the constitutional foundation for legislators to address that in statute. So maybe I'll go look at that. But that's really my premise. And I think the state engagement in child care is kind of long established through the Child Care Program Office. And then the question is, how do you best do it?
Representative,
and then one follow-up, if I might, Madam Co-Chair.
Yes.
So the policy call that would ultimately end up with a subsidy to the industry, potentially, result of that would be a policy that is promoting child care as a means to raise kids. And so we would be, the policy of a supplementing that portion of the industry would then be setting there's value to this. So does this, you're talking about a long-term cultural impact here across the sector, is this promoting or setting a standard at the state level or I guess promoting is the best word, that there's value in other people raising our children as opposed to parents raising their own children, since we're subsidizing one over the other?
Thanks to the chair. I guess it's my view that every parent should be able to make the choice about the best way to raise their children vis-a-vis how many parents work for wages and whether one or more parents is able to stay home and take care of their kids. I think the practical problem is there aren't a lot of jobs these days where one parent can work in the workforce and the other parent can stay home and take care of kids. There just aren't a lot of jobs where you can support a family that way, and that kind of gets at the need for child care, just for parents to be able to support their family. So maybe I didn't answer that. No, I'm not trying to dictate that child care is better than parents staying home. I think every parent should be able to make that choice freely.
Okay, I guess a follow-up would be, what if the solution also included a subsidy for parents to raise their kids? That would be a state policy that says we place value on parents staying home and raising their kids, as opposed to a policy that says we promote parents giving that responsibility to somebody else.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, personally, I actually think there's a lot of value in that, and there have been other policy discussions about, you know, people who stay home and take care of their elderly relatives, and a lot of states do that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, one thing, Representative Fields, that you might want to take a look at is a case that really stuck with me when I taught constitutional law for 5 years. It's called Lachlan Steele, L-A-U-G-H-L-I-N. It's around 1937. And the Supreme Court held, the United States held, that the right to organize was a fundamental right. It applied to the private sector right to organize, and it was an interpretation of the Wagner Act or the Fair Labor Standards Act, the bill you're talking about. And I think the other thing to consider relative to Representative Carpenter's point is simply the freedom of association, which is part of the right to organize. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Edgman.
You know, Alaska's population is getting older. In fact, the fastest growing segment, I think, are seniors in the state. And we are seeing more people actually choose not to stay in Alaska, but to leave the state. And it's not in, you know, significant quantities, I guess you could say, but it's pretty apparent. I think it's like 9-10 years consecutive that we've seen people essentially exit the state, and then in a few of those years be replaced by people coming back into the state to provide a net gain of population. But can you speak a little bit to, you know, from a demographic standpoint, the sector population that this bill might affect?
Through the chair, yes, the demographic trends we've seen in Alaska were definitely one of my motivations, and what we've seen is significant net out-migration among people of working age. We have an aging population on the one hand. I was just in a tribal affairs committee this morning and heard that the median age in the ABCP region is 25. So our population is becoming younger on one end of the spectrum and older on the other, and we're actually losing people of working age. And I think that's pretty problematic because you have fewer people earning and able to support their families. So one of the goals of this bill is to make sure it's practical for working age people to stay in Alaska, afford child care, participate in the workforce, and because of the reality of our aging population, and in many cases, ensure that there's a good environment to take care of aging relatives. I think we actually have an economic imperative to make sure it's practical for families both to raise their kids, but also to take care of parents who may be aging. When we retain those multi-generational families in Alaska, that's a good thing. And when it is only affordable to take care of multi-generational families outside, I think the loss of population, the loss of purchasing and economic activity in our state is a bad thing.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you, Representative Fields, for bringing this bill and with it this hearty discussion about a really complex issue. I mean, it's fascinating to think about the intersection of economic forces, social forces, all the things that are happening in our society and have been happening in our society over the last 30 years, the change that is taking place. Your bill looks to specifically address an issue that's real. I hear anecdotally all the time in my own community about the need for more child care options for parents. I think Representative Carpenter also brings up a very good point. You know, if we were to go down this road, would that be saying that we would be valuing at a higher level parents' ability to have their children raised not by themselves, at least entirely by themselves, but by child care providers? That's a pretty big question in terms of, you know, my heart says, no, that's not a good direction to go. Anyway, I don't really have a question, but it's just a great bill. I mean, it's a great bill for a discussion. Let's put it that way. And it's something that we do need to discuss. And I think that by just ignoring the problem, that's not gonna help. However, I don't know where we're gonna go with this kind of thing. But I applaud you for bringing it forward, because it's bringing about this discussion that's needed. So thank you.
Well, if I might respond through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I think your point about parents being able to provide care is important, and in my ideal world, people would have enough access to jobs that every single family could have one parent work outside the home and one parent provide care in the home if that was their choice. And I would almost ask if the, and we can follow up to see if the Child Care Program Office has ever looked at that, and whether such subsidies could be extended to parents who are raising kids at home, thereby foregoing wages in the private market. To me, that would be a balanced approach, and I don't know how much has been considered.
Thank you. We will move on to invited testimony. We have four invited testifiers today. First is Candy Ritchie. She's a child care provider at Candy's Tot Shop in Fairbanks. Welcome to House Finance. If you could place yourself on the record and please begin your testimony.
Hi, I am Candace Ritchie. I am the owner of Candy's Tot Shop, which is a licensed group home in the Fairbanks Northville area. I've been open and operating for 15 years. We often get asked what we need as providers, and we have conversations over these matters, but we have issues not being heard when we do talk. We've struggled for a long time in our field to get what we need. We really need support, and I think this is what's going to be offered with the House Bill 149. When I heard about the bill, I was in awe, because it covers topics that have been of concern for many years within this industry. The topics have been around Robin for many discussions. It includes the topics of us gaining a voice, which we've needed through the years, and including topics of wages and benefits such as leave, health insurance, and retirement. Through my years of work, I have found that I work long hours, anywhere between 12 and 16 hours a day, and the wages that I earn from this job are not enough for me to make a living and support my family. The same goes with hiring the staff to fill our positions. There's a high rate of turnover in the industry because we can't afford to pay our employees as much as others in the community. Over the years, finding qualified staff for the position has been hard enough, much less when we do find an employee for the position, it's hard to keep them because we cannot offer them what other employers do. I've had many individuals come through here and start work, but then they leave because I cannot offer a better employment package for them to keep them here. And this does not include the money that we also have to invest in getting the training and the background checks and everything else that they need to be here. We had state funds that were invested in our sector, and this showed just how powerless our industry was with our voice on how the money was used. Benefits are something that are off the table for myself because the premiums are way too high for me to get insurance as a small business. It's not affordable or sustainable to keep. So this means that my employees and myself cannot get benefits that are needed, such as health insurance. My career as a child care professional started 15 years ago, and having money to get from month to month was a concern. But adding and creating a retirement for myself has been virtually impossible. I have other bills that are a higher concern, that are more important than a retirement, such as putting food on the table and being able to pay the bills to remain open. With the cost of living in Alaska being so high, it leaves little for us to invest elsewhere. House Bill 149 will support my career field in many aspects. This bill will allow us to have a voice of what happens with our future in the industry. We will be able to have a say in where the state funds go for the child care and where it's needed most. We will be able to voice what we want for our future and how we would like to grow as an industry. We need the support now more than ever to make the future of child care in Alaska sustainable, affordable, and competitive with other industries in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ritchie. We appreciate you being here with us today. I see no questions. Next, we will move on to Christina Eubanks-Ohana with Hillcrest Children's Center in Anchorage. If you could place yourself on the record and please begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Christina Eubanks. I'm from Anchorage and the Executive Director of Hillcrest Children's Center, who has provided child care for Alaskans for the past 55 years. The reality of poor wages and benefits for this workforce detrimentally impacts our working families. A healthy early learning system requires a variety of providers, both home and center-based, that are well-trained and compensated and have a voice in their work conditions. I believe that House Bill 149 before you is an avenue to begin to address this issue. Attracting and retaining a quality workforce has been a continued struggle during the 18 years I worked in Alaska providing child care services. While the state has changed regulations that increase the cost of care, the reimbursement rates have not kept pace. This has meant an increase in cost to families and continued low wages and little to no benefits for the workers. The foundation of a high-quality early childhood system is a well-trained and fairly compensated workforce. Unfortunately, Alaska's system does not provide for livable wages to keep a trained workforce. Early childhood educators are among the lowest paid professions in the state. While the cost of child care is high, often comparable to a monthly mortgage or rent payment, that income does not cover overhead and wages, a livable wage. This leads to high rates of turnover in providers, which is alarming because of consistency in caregiving during a child's formative years is essential to provide a secure foundation for the child to grow from. This financial investment in early childhood saves the state money in education and health costs in the long term. While this bill does not fix all of the issues in early childhood, it provides a policy solution that allows a greater voice for staff, center directors, and home providers in working with the state child care program office. The industry should have a voice in decisions that impact the cost of care. We are the experts in providing care in Alaska and should be afforded a seat at the table. Examples of this is the child care program office receives the primary amount of its funding through the Child Care and Development Block Grant. At the beginning of the pandemic, policy created by the CCPO to support the industry actually came out and incentivized our closing. And so we had to advocate after the fact to them that they really looked at how they had written their regulations, it was going to incentivize us to close instead of stay open for essential workers. Additionally, during the last regulation change, again, the CCP office not having experience in running centers, just dealing with the financial mandates down from the federal government, created proposed regulation changes that would have substantially increased the cost of care to more than, well, close to double what it was. And again, we had to sit there at the fact during testimony, present and clarify and explain to them what the ramifications were. And what I see that this bill would allow us to do is allow us to be at the table at the beginning so we wouldn't have to constantly be looking at and figuring out what they're doing and what they don't understand, but have a space at the table to talk about it so we can work together to come up with solutions. And in regards to the question about the need for child care, our program where I serve 69 children is due to knowing kids that are going to go to kindergarten, we are able to pre-fill those slots with parents who are looking, and so right now my center is filled through May of 2023 with families who oftentimes we are the first people who are called when parents find out they're pregnant. They'll tell you because they to get guaranteed spots, and even with that, I get 1 to 2 calls a day of families asking and looking for child care right now, and so there is not enough spaces in the state to meet the current need.
And this would hopefully allow us to stabilize the field, be able to attract more providers, because it does not make financial sense to open a center at this time. And so we need to be doing everything in our power to incentivize providers to continue providing care for working families, allowing independent care, child care business owners the option to collectively negotiate with the state to raise reimbursement rates provides a way to increase wages and keep programs open. I urge your support for this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Eubanks-Ohana. I see no questions from the committee. Next, we have Rachel Byers with a Child's World Montessori School in Anchorage. She looks unavailable online. Ms. Byers, are you there? Okay, we will move on to Blue Shibler. She's with Southeast Alaska Association for Education of Young Children. Ms. Shibler, welcome to House Finance. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking time to hear testimony today about this critical issue facing our state. My name is Blue Scheidler. I'm a Juneau resident, and I'm currently serving as the executive director of AEYC in Juneau. But prior to that, I was a child care business owner for more than 20 years, so I saw firsthand many of the impacts being discussed here today about how low wages in this industry affect the quality of care that businesses can provide for families. And I just want to point out, too, that child care providers aren't trying to raise other people's children. We are partnering with working families to help children get their developmental needs met in high-quality environments. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about the conditions that child care providers and business owners are currently facing in Alaska. From my agency perspective, child care as a business model is in market failure and has been for quite a while. And when a necessary service, necessary because families need to work and put their children somewhere, when a necessary service fails to correct itself in a free market, public intervention is often needed. And the reason I say it's in market failure is because parents are already paying an average of 10 to 20% of income on child care costs, and that revenue still does not allow programs to pay worthy wages. Because that revenue or tuition income from parents is usually the sole source of revenue for child care businesses, they have no means to compete in the current labor market, which is very tight. So while coffee shops and grocery stores are increasing wages, they're offering hiring and retention bonuses and contributing to retirement accounts, child care wages are staying flat and falling well below what's considered livable in today's economy. I think building a strong quality supply of child care that's affordable for working families is critical for our state in moving toward economic recovery. And that effort really needs to start with creating better workforce conditions for child care providers. While my understanding of labor relations and sectoral bargaining is relatively low, I do believe that child care workers are key stakeholders in the child care industry, and they should be heard from when the state is making decisions about how to invest financial resources in the work that they do. And because there were some questions earlier, if I have time, I'd just like to say, in Juneau, I do have some data about how many families are out there looking for care. As of January of this year, we have 221 children on wait lists in Juneau child care programs. And while some of those programs have technical spots open or capacity to fill some of those kids up from wait lists, they don't have enough staff to care for the kids. So pair that number of 221 children on wait lists, they programs report a total of needing 16 to 20 more employees in their programs in order to start taking kids off their wait list and enrolling them in care.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Scheidler. We appreciate your testimony today. I see no questions from the committee, and I will go ahead and we will move on to public testimony. I'm opening public testimony on House Bill 149. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? I see no one. Online, it looks like we have Mike Coons from Palmer. Welcome back, Mr. Coons. If you could state your name, affiliation, and please begin your testimony.
Yes, this is Mike Ernest. Am I coming across for Fratchy or am I coming across? Okay.
Can you repeat that, please?
Am I coming across Fratchy or am I coming across okay?
He's not coming across well. I'm not what he's saying.
We're having a difficult time hearing you.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of afraid of. Okay.
That's much better.
I'm just going to speak out louder then. My name is Mike Pence from Palmer, and I'm speaking for myself. I'm taking notes on what's going on. First off, thanks to China Harris, more moms staying home and finding out how badly their kids are being taught. Now with this increase in gasoline costs, more will stay home to save transportation dollars, and then homeschool, which takes at their schools, which also reduces the cost of childcare to zero. To Representative Rosenson, how does Janus overrule your discussed 1930s school district plan? So with this bill, how much more would it cost in order to be in unions? To have unions, the unions cost, and unions pay the union fees, as well as the union lobbyists. So it's going to be a lot more money being shelled out and less money in that worker's pocket. As the Commissioner on Aging, we found out during this last year in Kenai that a lot of health care providers were reduced because they were going to be losing their unemployment if they worked full-time, and if they worked full-time, they weren't going to make as much money as they were getting subsidized with unemployment. Lastly, and probably most importantly, which I find such I just about laughed, my fell off the chair and laughed, Representative DeField, I kept on talking, touting how great it was in California. California? Representative DeField, that's your best example? Really? The People's Democratic Republic of California, the most socialist, communist, Marxist state in the United States, and you use an immigrant example? I don't think so. Vote no on H.M. 48.
Thank you, Mr. Coons. We appreciate you calling in today. Is there anyone else online wishing to testify? We have Nicole Thibodeau from the Department of Labor. Are you here for public testimony or for here to go over the fiscal note?
Madam Co-Chair, this is Nicole Thibodeau from the Alaska Labor Relations Agency.
Yes, are you here for public testimony?
I am not. I am here to answer questions about the fiscal note.
That's what I thought. No problem. Okay, I see no one else online or in the room wishing to testify. So with that, I'll close public testimony. And now we will go to Ms. Thibodeau regarding the fiscal note. It looks like control code UVINQ. Ms. Thibodeau?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair. As I said, I'm with the Alaska Labor Relations Agency. I am the hearing examiner and administrator, and the Alaska Labor Relations Agency, or ALRA, administers the Public Employment Relations Act, and under the Act, ALRA's mission is to promote harmonious and cooperative relations between government and its employees. We do this by settling disputes between public employers and unions and by overseeing representation elections. So this legislation would create a bargaining unit of child care workers, and under the Public Employment Relations Act, ALRA would conduct a mail ballot representation election to determine the unit composition and the representatives. And that election is expected to be a one-time cost of between approximately $16,000 and $46,000 if every employee gets a vote. So the cost range reflects uncertainty with respect to the bargaining unit size. We used estimates of numbers of workers, not providers. And so based on THRED's 2020 Economic Impact Report, they estimate that there are about 6,500 direct child care providers in Alaska. The State of Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development Research and Analysis Unit estimates pre-pandemic child care worker numbers to be between about 3,200 and 3,300. And so our estimate of the bargaining unit size is based on between 3,200 and 6,500 workers or voters. And just to give you some perspective, after reviewing our last 7 years' worth of data, on average, we conduct about 2 elections per year, and the average unit size is about 19. So with our staff of 3 and our very streamlined budget, this election would be a one-time significant expense and effort for our agency.
Great, thank you.
So, go ahead.
No, please continue.
So just to do a quick rundown of the numbers, the costs that were included in the fiscal note include a hearing. We estimate that labor would include either a temp or contracting out assistance to produce ballots in the neighborhood of about $3,500. Mail ballot postage would be in the neighborhood of $3,800 to $7,800. Ballot packets would be in the neighborhood of $4,000 to $7,000. We'd have a regulations project of about $500. We anticipate legal fees to the Attorney General's office being between $0 and $10,000. We would be reprinting our pamphlet 900 for about $2,000, and a hearing would potentially cost between $1,800 and $15,000 for a total of between $16,000 and $46,000. And that's all I have about our fiscal note, if there aren't any other questions.
Thank you. Any questions on the fiscal note? I see none. Thank you,
Madam Co-Chair. I do have a question.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. My question, does ALRA manage any other private sector collective bargaining elections?
Ms. Thibodeau?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, no, we don't. We just handle public sector collective bargaining.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? I see none. Representative Fields, thank you for being here today and presenting House Bill 149. With that, we'll take a brief.
I do have another question. I'm sorry.
Representative Carpenter.
This is actually a financial question, too, Madam Co-Chair, for our Finance Committee. And I take into account the public conversation that we just heard, and my takeaway from it was twofold. One, it was recognized that a strong economy, more jobs, higher paying jobs is necessary. And I also heard that some amount of state subsidy is also necessary. I understand the bill is not doing subsidy right now. It's just offering the ability to do some collective bargaining. So the question in my mind is, if we were to go down this road and the subsidy is what the individuals are wanting who are going to elect to bargain within this industry, then where do we see the subsidy coming from? Largely the folks that are doing the daycare are not paying corporate income taxes now. That's my assumption due to their size. And so they're not paying into the tax, into the state revenue. So our pools of money at that point that would be paying for the subsidy would be some amount of the corporate income tax that we collect, either through non-oil or oil revenue, our permanent fund earnings, or through a federal subsidy of some sort. So the question that I would have to the maker of the bill would be, where would it be likely to come from? Where would he see this additional money coming from that it is clear that the individuals who might want to unionize would want to see the subsidy at the state level? Where would we have that money come from?
Thanks, through the chair. The ongoing federal funding stream is called the Child Care Development Block Grant that was increased under recently passed federal legislation. And when that was increased, to me, it kind of heightened the need to empower providers to negotiate and help drive those investments. Whether the state wants to also increase investments in child care, I think, is a good question, but potentially an additional question beyond this bill's contemplation of a sectoral bargaining structure.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. So just to clarify, so it would be your intention that the likely follow-on action of subsidy would be a subsidy from available federal funds, at least to begin with. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, yes. Given that there are recently increased federal funds, I think it's a good time to ask ourselves, do we have the best structure for this industry to have a seat at the table working with the state? That is not to preclude the question of whether we as a legislature should do more for childcare, but I think there's a need right now to empower the sector given the increased federal funds.
Okay, thank you. And that's where I'll hold the questions for now. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter. Anything further? I see none. Thank you, Representative Fields and Mr. Walsh, for being here and presenting House Bill 149. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. This concludes our meeting for this morning. Our next meeting will be this afternoon at 1:30, where we will hear an introduction of House Bill 220, Retirement Systems Defined Benefit Option. With that, at 10:07 a.m., we are adjourned.